22-year-old Logan Sinclair shuffles into an interview room at the Parma Police Station in Parma, Ohio, a city on the southern edge of Cleveland. He's wearing a white and blue hospital gown. His left arm is in a sling, and he hunches over while walking, assisted by a uniformed police officer. The officer helps him hobble over to one of two office chairs behind a desk. Logan sits down and lets out an audible groan. A plainclothed detective then enters the room and asks if he wants something to drink, water or a pop, and he tearfully says he'll take a pop. He leans back in his chair and winces in pain. It's December 1st, 2015. Just 2 days earlier, the house where Logan lived with his girlfriend and her mom was surrounded by Parma police officers. A SWAT team armored vehicle was parked out front, and one of the officers was yelling into the vehicle's PA system for Logan to come out with his hands up. Parked in the driveway was a gold Toyota Camry with visible blood drops on the inside and outside. There was also blood on the door to the house. Suddenly, the front door opened and Logan appeared, one arm in the air. The officers closest to him were yelling commands now, telling him to put both arms up. Logan tearfully called out that he was injured and that his left arm wasn't working. He couldn't put it into the air. He slowly backed towards the officers, and when he got close enough, they tackled him to the ground, placing him in handcuffs. Meanwhile, just 6 minutes down the road, at the Seneca gas station on Pearl Road, yellow crime scene tape was being put up. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 101. Detective Jeff Wells read Logan his Miranda rights.
While we're waiting on the pop, just so you know, anytime we bring somebody in here, we got to read them the rights, okay? So you do have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him present with you while you're being questioned. And if you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed to you before any questioning. And then you can decide to exercise these rights at any time. Do you understand your rights?
Yes, sir.
Yes, okay.
Logan agreed to speak with him. After asking Logan some basic questions about his family and where he works, Detective Wells then told him that he wanted to talk about what happened two nights prior at the Seneca gas station.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie to you, Logan. You kind of got yourself into a little bit of a spot here. But my thing is to figure out, why did Logan get to this point?
What am I getting charged?
Well, right now I'm investigating what happened at the gas station. Okay, so. But I only have one side of the story. That's why I always like to talk to people. We could have been jerked. We could have taken you right downstairs. And I mean, I'd rather talk to you first. It's only fair, right? There's two sides to every story. That's what we always
do. Did anybody die?
Well, we're going to talk about that. Somebody got hurt, okay?
Please tell me no one.
Well, I want to talk about what leads up to that, okay? So, because the day we're talking about is Saturday, all right?
Detective Wells asked him to tell him about his day on that Saturday. Logan said he was drinking straight Crown Royal whiskey and driving around by himself. He said he had done a lot of cocaine the night before and didn't sleep. He started crying and said he knows that what he did was wrong. He told Detective Wells that just after dark, he pulled up behind the Seneca gas station, took a shot of Crown Royal, and did a line of coke. He said he parked behind the building because he didn't want anyone to see him drinking. He said he walked into the store to buy something, and something just clicked that he didn't have any money. He reached into his coat pocket, he thinks for money, and felt a gun that he had put there earlier. He told Detective Wells that he had gotten the gun from his dealer a couple days prior. He had never fired a gun before and didn't have a concealed carry permit. With his gun now in his hand and pointed at the owner of the gas station, who was behind the cash register, Logan said he demanded money. He grabbed the money and put that and the gun back in his pocket. Detective Wells clarified with him that he took the money and put it in his pocket, Logan said yes, and then said, I'm sorry.
Listen, we all make mistakes, Logan. We do.
It's a big mistake.
It is a big mistake. Well, I mean, what do you think you're guilty of? I mean, like, what did you...
I know people think he's okay. Mm-hmm. I hope he's okay.
And what did people tell you when you asked them?
They said they don't know.
Right.
They can't tell me.
Well, they probably don't know. Okay. Remember anybody else being in the store?
Yeah, there were two guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they were...
So here, so you get the money, and you said you put your gun away?
I put my gun away.
And then you're trying to walk out?
I was.
What happens?
And as I'm walking, as soon as I touch the door, I just hear banging, and I look over, and I'm like, stop, sir, please, stop. And he said, fuck you, Jesus.
Did you feel like you were shot at that point?
Yeah. I know I was sad because I went to open the door, and I just...
Your arm didn't work?
Yeah.
He told Detective Wells that he started to walk out when the owner said something to him. He looked back, and the owner then shot at him, striking him in the arm. He fell to the ground, and the owner ran over and stood over him, threatening him. There were two other guys in the store at that time. While lying on the ground with the owner over him, pointing a gun at him, Logan then pulled out his gun again and shot him back, he said. I didn't want to hurt anyone, he told the detective.
And then, so after you ran out of the store, where did you go?
To my car.
Which was parked around back? Well, actually, not your car, Christine's car, right? Okay. And then you get in the, do you realize you're shot at that point, or no?
I was scared. I realized I was shot. I thought I was going
to
die.
You didn't stop in the parking lot at all, did you?
No.
You just ran right to the car, and then what?
I thought I was going to die.
I thought I was going to die, he said. He said he was bleeding from his arm and buttocks. While he was in his car heading home, he called his girlfriend and told her that he got shot and needed help. When he got home, he said he tried to take the bullets out with a pair of scissors. Detective Wells told him that they searched his house and found the jacket he was wearing that night, the jacket with the money in it. He asked him if that was the money from the gas station, and Logan said yes, that he had never robbed anyone before in his life, so it must be from that.
That was your first robbery in your whole life?
Yeah, I've never done nothing like this, man.
Yeah.
I've never even shot a gun before. I mean, I have one.
Right.
I had a handgun.
Detective Wells asked where he came from before going to the gas station, and Logan said his house. Detective Wells then told him that he went somewhere else. Where? Logan asked. You tell me, Detective Wells responded. I robbed another place, Logan admitted. Logan spoke to another detective, this one from Cleveland, who questioned him about a robbery he admitted to committing just prior to Sunoco. In that robbery, he said he walked up to the counter with a gun and demanded money. After the cashier gave it to him, he said, thank you, I'm sorry, and then left. He said he only got $40 or $50. Later, Detective Wells came back in, and Logan offered up a possible motive for the robberies. He said he owed his dealer about $700.
Did you think you were going to die?
Yeah, dude.
You know what? You're lucky. Really lucky.
I thought I was going to die on the gas station floor, dude. When I looked up at him, I thought he...
I mean, that's got to be a life-changing moment for you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure, you're looking down the barrel of a gun, right?
You know, I shot him twice.
What?
Did you shoot him at all, you said?
Really?
Yeah, when he was shooting at me.
Yeah? And what happened after you shot him with him, do you know?
I don't know. He stopped shooting, mm-hmm. and I just threw my gun down and ran.
Throughout the interview, Logan continuously asked about the Sunoco gas station owner he had shot and what happened to him. At the end of the interview, Detective Wells put the charging document in front of him.
I'm going to show you what you're being held here for. Now, let me explain you this before I show you this. Most likely tomorrow, you're going to go up to court.
Mm-hmm.
You'll go in front of a judge. The judge is going to set your bond or your bail. Same thing, bond, bail. And he's going to read you the formal charges and stuff like that. This is just your initial appearance. Mm-hmm. The case ultimately wound up down at Cuyahoga County because we don't have jurisdiction on felony cases. All right. So ultimately, it'll be down at county. All right. You have a long road ahead of you. Read your charge, okay? But you'll go in front of the judge tomorrow. All right. Well, here you can read it from here, okay?
What is it?
What's that? You
aggravated
can read
murder. No, he died.
He did pass away. He did. I don't know why. I wish I did. But, I mean, I know why it happened now, but he didn't make it. He didn't make it.
It's a murder.
It is. It's aggravated murder.
They were charging Logan with aggravated murder. The gas station owner, 50-year-old Bob Sposit, had passed away. At first, it seemed as though Logan's case would be somewhat open and shut. After all, he had confessed to Detective Wells in that interview room, and in October 2016, he stood in front of a judge and pleaded guilty. Before the guilty plea, however, Logan had attempted suicide while in prison. The judge ordered a competency evaluation, and it was determined that he was competent and ineligible for mental health court participation. At his plea hearing, prosecutors told the judge that the minimum sentence Logan could receive was a life sentence with parole eligibility at 26 years, and the maximum would be life without parole. Logan told the court that he understood and said he wanted to plead guilty to the charges. But just days before he was scheduled to be sentenced, Logan was back in court, this time petitioning to withdraw his guilty plea. In part, his attorneys argued that, quote, "We are perfectly aware of the fact that Mr. Sposit tragically died and that it was a firearm that Mr. Sinclair brought into the store. But there is a plethora of events which occurred between the time Mr. Sinclair began to walk out the door with his back to Mr. Sposit and when those shots were fired that are the subject of the indictment. What he pled to was an aggravated murder, and we've proceeded through this entire 10 or 11 month process preparing for trial, and I have never had an aggravated murder case in 23 years, Your Honor, where a defendant was shot not once, but twice before the act of aggravated murder occurred. So I'd hope that would submit to you, Your Honor, that there are many trial issues that would relate to various levels of culpability of this death. It is that issue that we believe needs to be heard by a jury, Your Honor." They also told the court that they didn't go over all the possible penalties of aggravated murder with their client, particularly the parole review process. In addition to that, they said the suicide attempt played a part in his distress at the time of his plea as well. The judge told the court that as much as he hated to do it, he would allow Logan to withdraw his plea, and a trial date was set. So in March 2017, in a courtroom in Parma, Ohio, prosecutors gave their opening statements in the state of Ohio versus Logan Daniel Sinclair. Prosecutor Dan Cleary told the jury that both robberies, the one at the Seneca gas station in Parma, as well as the earlier one at Charlie's Beverages in Cleveland, were captured on surveillance video. The two robberies occurred within a half hour of each other. Cleary described for the jury what the surveillance video from the Seneca gas station would show. He said you can see Logan enter the store, go immediately to the register, where the owner, Bob Sposit, was standing, pull out a gun and start threatening Bob to give him money. He put the gun right in Bob's face, he said. But what Logan didn't realize is that Bob was a concealed carry weapon holder. Cleary told the jury that running a convenience store like this is a dangerous business and that it's not uncommon for these types of business owners to have weapons. Cleary said Logan got the money and started to leave. He told Bob not to come around the counter when Bob pulled out his gun and fired, striking Logan, who then fell to the ground. Meanwhile, Cleary said two men, a father and son, pulled into the parking lot and saw what was going on inside. He said both men are hearing impaired. They can't speak, but they can sign. He told the court that Bob's gun jammed, so Bob went over to where Logan was laying on the ground. Logan was crying and screaming, "Stop, it's over, it's over." Bob stood over him and threatened him, saying, "Don't you fucking move or I'll kill you." The father and son, Steve Oska Sr. and Steve Oska Jr., came into the store then. Bob turned his head for a second to tell them to call 911 when Logan pulled out his gun and shot Bob four times. Bob was dead before he hit the ground, Cleary said. He told the court that Logan then fired at Steve Oska Jr., who was going to the phone near the back of the store to call 911. Steve Oska Sr. then jumped on him, and a struggle ensued. The gun went off again as they struggled. Oska Sr. was able to get the gun, and as Logan ran away, Oska Sr. then fired the gun at him. Logan, who was shot in the arm and buttocks, ran into his car that was parked behind the station and drove away. A witness who was in the parking lot was able to get a partial license plate number. Cleary said that when Detective Wells interviewed Logan, Logan completely admitted to his involvement, to that, and also to the robbery in Cleveland. "This isn't a whodunit," Cleary said. "We absolutely have the right guy." Quote, "It's going to be up to each and every one of you to tell us what level of culpability he shares. He's to blame for it. Folks, I'm going to implore with you during all of this testimony to keep one theme in mind, okay? Remember who was just living their life that night working and who was out there robbing." Cleary said that the theme is that if Logan didn't rob either of these places, they wouldn't be here. Quote, "Every piece of evidence that you hear should be taken with that theme in mind, because that's the truth. He doesn't go into the Seneca. Bob is alive, period." Jeff Richardson, Logan's attorney, called the case tragic on every level. "There is no one whose life here is better because of this," he said. He told the court that they can't argue against some of what Cleary said. "It would be silly to do because it's all on video. But there's a difference between what's reflected in that video and what the testimony will indicate to you," he said. He said when Logan entered the store, he did pull out a handgun, did go behind the counter, and did demand money from the register. He took the money, put it in his pocket. But more importantly, he said, Logan then put the handgun into his pocket and was walking towards the door. He was about a step away from the door when Bob quickly pulled out his gun and fired a shot. The shot struck Logan in the back of the left arm. Logan then attempted to get out the door, but Steve Oska Sr. was blocking it. What happened next, he said, would be for the jury to decide. He told them that Logan was shot twice and that they believe that both shots came from inside the gas station. He said the state says that Bob only shot once and that his gun jammed, but he does re-rack it, and as Logan is hitting the door, he is then shot right above his butt in the small of his back. That second shot caused him to fall onto his back, he said, and at that point, Bob approached him and stood over him with a gun. Richardson argued that's not a gun that had jammed, because if it was, it wasn't being handled like one. Bob was standing over Logan, telling him not to move or I'll kill you, which is understandable, he said. Quote, "It just gets worse. At this point, Logan is on the ground, two bullets in him. Someone is standing over him with a gun, someone who has already fired twice. Mr. Oska Sr. and his son enter, I expect with good intentions. No questions about that. But it escalates this even further." He said Oska Sr. jumped onto Logan's upper torso while he was on the floor, and they started wrestling. The gun went off again. He conceded that Logan got up and ran outside, and that Oska Sr. did pick up the gun and run after him. But there are no indications that he ever fired that gun, he said. Oska Sr. only believed he fired it once or twice, implying that he couldn't hear the gun go off due to his hearing loss. He told the court that no shell casings were found outside the gas station and that the police never tried to prove that Oscar Sr. fired the gun. No gunshot residue or metal tests were done, he said. Quote, so what we have are a bunch of shell casings. We've got a little bit of blood. We have, tragically, a man who lost his life. And we now have a young man shot twice, running back to his girlfriend's mom's home. He said the government has suggested that this was planned with prior calculation and design. Quote, I don't think anybody's nightmare would have included what happened here. He said Logan is not a murderer and that the evidence will show that he's not. Now, I want to pause here and talk a little bit about the differences in the prosecution's theory and the defense's theory. What's not in dispute is that Logan indeed went inside the gas station with a gun and the intent to rob it, and that he did so. What's also not in dispute is that Logan was shot twice, and Bob was shot four times. Now, here's where the differences in the prosecution's and the defense's theories lie. The prosecution believes that Logan was shot once by Bob inside the gas station. Then Logan shot Bob four times, attempted to shoot Steve Oscar Jr. as he was running to the phone, and was then shot a second time by Steve Oscar Sr. as he was fleeing the scene in the parking lot. The defense, however, contends that Logan was shot twice by Bob, and that Bob was standing over him, threatening him, when Logan then shot and killed him. So what theory would the jury believe, and would it matter with regards to culpability? Haseeb Merhi was the first witness the state called to the stand. He told the court his nickname is Joe, so I'll be referring to him as that throughout this episode. Joe told the court that he works at a convenience store called Charlie's Beverages in Cleveland. On November 28, 2015, he was working there with another man whom he called Mr. Russo. He said Mr. Russo is a local man who comes in and does some work for them sometimes, like cleans and puts deliveries away. At around 7 p.m., there were no customers inside. Joe was sitting down and doing some paperwork while Mr. Russo was reading the paper. He heard the door buzzer go off, and so he stood up. He saw a male wearing a winter hat that covered a portion of his face walk in. He watched as the man walked towards him. When he was about 4 or 5 feet away, he saw the man pull a gun. The counter is low, he said, and the man jumped over it and demanded that he open the cash register. Joe told him to take it easy as he opened it. The man grabbed the bills and, with the gun still pointing towards Joe, jumped back over the counter and left the store. He testified that he couldn't remember what the man had said to him on his way out, but knew he had said something. He was soft-spoken and wasn't yelling. He thinks it was, if you follow me, I'll kill you, or something like that, but he wasn't sure. He said he grabbed the phone to call 911. He opened the door to the parking lot and looked out, but no one was there. The man was gone. The surveillance video was played for the jury, which showed what happened exactly as Joe had described in his testimony. On cross-examination, Joe told the court that there was only $40 in the cash register. He was asked if he had a concealed carry permit and if there was a gun inside the store, and he said yes to both. When asked why he didn't do anything to intervene or defend himself, he said he didn't feel like he needed to. On redirect, Prosecutor Cleary asked, if the gun was closer to you, do you think you would have used it? And he replied, chances, yes. Carlo Russo, the local man who was working with Joe at the time, testified that he heard the robber say, give me your money, after he jumped over the counter. Then, as he was leaving, he said, if you come outside, I'll shoot you. He said he was about 8 to 10 feet away from the encounter when it occurred. He described the robber's demeanor as anxious. Steve Oscar Jr. testified that on November 28, 2015, he went to his local convenience store, Sunoco, with his father. It was around 9 p.m. and it was dark outside. As they pulled into the parking lot, he said they saw a suspicious-looking man walking into the store. He had a hoodie on and his face was covered. He and his dad walked up to the door and could see that the man was robbing the store. He testified that the man tried to leave the store, but that when he pushed the door to open it, his dad held it closed, blocking him in. He said the store owner, Bob, pulled out a gun and then gunfire erupted. Bob was then holding the man down and turned and told him to call 911. Neither he nor his dad had a phone, but there was a phone across the store. Quote, "There was gunfire going on, so I couldn't get by that phone. So he let go and then he pointed the gun at me. Dad grabbed him and then there was gunfire and somebody got shot and they fell over dead. And then the robber tried to shoot at me and it went right over my head. Dad tried to save me from that and then he left. So I called 911. Dad called 911 after that. That's what happened." Oscar Jr. was explaining very quickly what had happened. Prosecutor Cleary had him slow down and asked him specific questions one by one. He was asked more about the robber trying to shoot at him. Quote, "You testified that you either felt or saw someone shoot at you, correct?" Oscar Jr. said, "Must be. I'm not really sure. Maybe I got lucky and it just happened so fast." "But did you feel or see someone shoot at you?" "I don't know. I saw the gun. He was going to shoot at me. I ducked and then the bullets came. He was going to kill me. You know, I didn't want, I ducked so I wouldn't get shot, you know? I'm not an idiot. Be a deer in headlights." He said he took cover. When the police arrived, they got an interpreter and he and his dad gave a statement. They then went to the police station where they were formally interviewed. The surveillance video was played again, and at one point, Prosecutor Cleary asked about the robber, "Which way is his arm pointing?" Oscar Jr. said it was pointing towards him. He said he would have gotten hit if he hadn't ducked. Oscar Sr. then grabbed the robber's wrist, and the gun went off again. On cross-examination, he said he is 100% deaf. He said he couldn't hear the gunshots that night, but that he felt the vibrations from them. Defense attorney Jim McDonnell asked if Bob was the first person to fire a gun that night, and Oscar Jr. said yes. He also agreed that Logan was trying to leave the store when he was shot and that his dad blocked him in. Steve Oscar Sr. testified that after Bob was shot, he grabbed Logan because he didn't want him to run away. He was holding him down and they struggled. He said Logan went to fire his gun and he grabbed his wrist, causing him to miss whoever he was shooting at. He said he thought Logan was aiming at his son. Logan then dropped the gun and left. He said he picked up the gun and ran after him. He shot the gun either once or twice. He doesn't remember, but he knows he pulled the trigger because he felt it go off. On cross-examination, he reiterated that he had fired the gun once, he said, at the robber. "I did fire that one shot. I'm telling the truth," he said. He said he gave his jacket to the police. He also testified that he believes Bob fired the first shot, although he couldn't be sure. Jason Piazza, a police officer with the city of Parma and who is fluent in sign language, testified that he interviewed Steve Oscar Sr. and Steve Oscar Jr. He said it wasn't communicated to him at the scene that Oscar Sr. had fired a gun that evening. He said he didn't learn about that until later at the station. But although he wasn't told that initially, he said his original intent was to find out where the suspect was and if anyone else had any injuries. The info about the gun wouldn't normally come up until they did a second interview and once the scene was secure. On cross-examination, he was asked about a note in his report where he told another officer that one of the handguns on the scene had been taken out of the store and then brought back and laid down. He said he didn't recall that. He also said he did not remember if a gunshot residue test was ever performed. Detective Jonathan Fullerton, a detective with the city of Parma, said he got the call for the shooting at Sunoco, but since so many officers had already responded there, he was checking the area for the suspect vehicle. The info he had received was that a man had been shot inside the gas station and the suspect had fled in a tan vehicle. The suspect was a younger male, approximately 20 years old, with blondish hair. A witness had written down a license plate number, but when Detective Fullerton typed it into the system, it came back to a black truck, not their suspect vehicle. He began running variations of the plate number, and after several tries, he came up with a vehicle that closely resembled the one they were looking for. It was a tan Toyota four-door sedan. He got the address and then realized that he was familiar with the registered owner of the car from another complaint. He knew that there was a younger male who lived at that residence who closely matched the suspect description. Detective Fullerton drove to the address and parked on the street. He saw the tan Toyota in the driveway. He radioed that he was going to check on the vehicle and then he approached. He looked inside and observed several red stains that he believed to be fresh blood. He got back on the radio and said he observed what appeared to be fresh blood stains, and so he requested backup. He then stepped back behind the garage of the neighbor's house, where he stood there observing until backup arrived. After additional officers arrived on the scene, Detective Fullerton's job was to secure the backyard, along with another officer. He testified that he heard over the radio that a person had exited the house. He went to the front yard and saw Logan on the ground. His arm wasn't moving and he had fresh blood on his arm. On cross-examination, he was asked if at any point he heard someone say, "I'm not a murderer," and he said yes. It was a voice he didn't recognize. Another officer with the city of Parma, Officer Edward Charles Pink Jr., testified that he responded to the residence after Officer Fullerton called it in. He said after Logan surrendered, and while he was on the ground, he kept saying, "I didn't mean to shoot him. I'm not a murderer. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." He said Logan said this several times without them asking any questions. After he did a sweep of the house, Officer Pink then came back out. By this time, paramedics were tending to Logan, and he heard him say, "Why did this happen to me? Why did he shoot me? I'm sorry," several times. He said there were no other occupants inside the home. On cross-examination, he agreed that after they started giving commands over the armored vehicle's PA system, it didn't take long for Logan to come out. The prosecution introduced several witnesses to testify about the two firearms found at the scene. James Mack, a crime scene technician with the Parma Police Department, testified that as he opened the door to the gas station, he could see an unidentified white male who was deceased. There was a rug in the front of the store, and numerous shell casings were on the ground. There was also a pair of slippers, a black shoe, and two firearms, along with a fur-lined winter hat. One of the firearms was made by the company Walther. This was believed to be Bob's gun. There were five unfired bullets recovered from the weapon. One was in the chamber, and four were in the magazine. Officer Mack testified that the gun would have fired eight bullets. So if the gun had been fully loaded, that would mean it had been fired three times. The other firearm was from the company High Point. This gun was Logan's. There were no bullets located in the magazine or the chamber. Officer Mack said this gun could fire nine bullets, which means that all nine bullets were fired if the gun had been fully loaded. He testified that eight cartridge casings were recovered from the scene. On cross-examination, he was asked if he was ever told that one of the firearms at the scene had been picked up, taken outside of the crime scene, and then brought back in and laid down. He said yes, he had been told that, but he said that fact was not in his police report. He also said he never interviewed Steve Oska Sr. to ask him if where he had laid the gun down was where police had found it, or whether it had been moved. He agreed that in the video, Oska Sr. is seen leaving with the gun, but when he comes back into the store, you can't see it. Logan's attorney pointed out that there were 12 bullets total missing from the guns, presuming that 12 shots had been fired. Only eight casings were recovered from the scene, and he agreed that it was possible that there were four more. That's why they went back to the scene a second time, he said. He told the jury that there wasn't a lot of blood at the Sunoco gas station, and that a lot more was found at the residence. He said they didn't swab any of the bloodstains found there. Michael E. Roberts works in the firearms department of the state crime lab. He testified that he examined both guns, along with the 8 fired cartridge casings. He test-fired both guns, and both appeared to be operable. He said there were 2 different brands of cartridge cases, but that it's common for people to have different brands and that they could have come from either gun. However, he testified that he was able to determine that one of the fired cartridge casings was fired from the Walther pistol, Bob's gun, while the remaining 7, he said, was from the High Point, which was Logan's gun. On cross-examination, he said he didn't run an analysis with respect to the gun's trigger pulls, meaning how much pressure has to be applied to the trigger to fire the gun. The Walther, Bob's gun, has something called double action, meaning the first squeeze of the trigger takes more pressure than the second squeeze. In other words, the Walther has a hammer that has to be cocked. The High Point, Logan's gun, does not. Roberts agreed that it would be easier to pull the trigger on Logan's gun. He was then asked, if you were presented with information about a struggle over a handgun, would these characteristics about trigger pull weights be much more relevant and important to you? He responded, I would think so. Yes, I would think so. And you were never asked to analyze that, correct? Correct, he said. On redirect, Prosecutor Cleary asked, and no one ever told you about a struggle over the handgun? That's correct, Roberts said. We just found out about it too, Cleary responded. Andrea McCullum, the deputy medical examiner, conducted Bob's autopsy. She said he had 4 gunshot wounds, 1 on the head, 1 in the neck, 1 on the right chest, and 1 under his left armpit. She testified that he had severe coronary artery disease and that he had electrocardiogram pads, which are used to check for a heartbeat. His official cause of death, she said, were multiple gunshot wounds to the head, neck, and trunk, with vascular, visceral, skeletal, and brain injuries. The manner of death was homicide while at work. She said the at work part is just part of their normal protocol. The results of the toxicology test concluded that there were small amounts of codeine and some caffeine in his system at the time he died. She said codeine is an opiate used for pain relief. Detective Jeff Wells, the lead detective who interviewed Logan, testified that throughout the interview, Logan kept asking if Bob had passed away. He said he wouldn't tell him because he wanted to talk about what had happened first. In Logan's version of events, he told Detective Wells that he was trying to get out the door, but that he couldn't because his arm wasn't working after having been shot. He said Bob stood over him, said, "Fuck you," and then shot him again. Logan said he then shot back. "I shot him after he shot me," he said. Towards the end of the interview, Detective Wells told Logan that Bob had passed away. He said Logan told him that he's going to go to jail for a really long time and that he shouldn't have talked to him. He was again crying. On cross-examination, attorney Jeff Richardson harped on the fact that Oscar Sr.'s clothing wasn't tested and that no gunshot residue tests were run. Detective Wells said he believed that Oscar Sr. fired a gun because he said he did. Richardson said, "We know he picked up the gun as Logan left the store. We know he runs out behind Logan." But he asked Detective Wells if any shell casings were ever found outside, and he said no. Richardson then asked if in the video, Logan ever flinches as he's running away. Detective Wells says he can't say for sure. Richardson asked if Logan fell down outside. Detective Wells said no, just inside the store. He agreed that Logan was shot twice and agreed that when Oscar Sr. said he fired the gun, there's nothing to corroborate that. Richardson said they both agree that Logan's claim that Bob was standing over him and shooting wasn't true. As for what medications Logan was on after he was released from the hospital and when he spoke with detectives, Detective Wells said he didn't know. He also testified that Logan's clothes were never analyzed and that the fact that Oscar Sr. had picked up the gun, brought it outside, and then it ended up back inside was not in any report. After Detective Wells' testimony, the state then rested. Logan's defense team declined to call any witnesses, and so they rested too. Prosecutor Carrie Sowell handled the first closing for the state. She referred to a point in the surveillance video where Logan is lying on his back, Bob is standing over him. Logan is saying, "It's over, it's over." "But we all know it wasn't over," she said. "Mr. Sposit is trying to get the police there by having the OSCAs call for the police, but the defendant wants nothing to do with the police." At that point, he takes his opportunity. As soon as Mr. Sposit turns away and is not paying attention to him, he takes his opportunity and shoots him at close range 4 times. He shoots him in his head, ladies and gentlemen. He has the purpose to kill Mr. Sposit. She said he then turned and pointed the gun at OSCA Jr., who was trying to get the police there. "Again, he doesn't want the police there," she said. She said he only surrendered after the large tank came to the house. And while he was at the hospital, according to medical personnel, he was malingering as a way to not go to jail. She noted that that was in his medical records the jury could look at. She told the jury it's aggravated murder. She said, "We know the defendant went into the Sunoco with the intention to rob the place. And then when it doesn't go his way, as he's lying on the ground, he waits for the perfect opportunity, turns and shoots Mr. Sposit." During both robberies, he said, "If you follow me out, I'll kill you." That is exactly what he did. "Ladies and gentlemen, that is aggravated murder," she said. Prosecutor Sowell then walked the jury through the other charges Logan was facing. On the aggravated robbery charge, she said that in attempting or committing a theft offense, did he inflict or attempt to inflict serious physical harm on him? "You don't get more serious than death," she said. On the felonious assault counts, she said when he was struggling on the ground with Steve OSCA Sr. and when he pointed the gun at Steve OSCA Jr. and fired, those were felonious assaults. On kidnapping, she said, when Logan was holding the gun at Bob and when he had nowhere to go because if he moves, he will be shot, that's kidnapping. Then there were the aggravated robbery counts for the first robbery at Charlie's Beverages, as well as a kidnapping count. She said when he held the gun to Joe at the register, he couldn't go anywhere. That was kidnapping, she said. Jeff Richardson gave the closing arguments on Logan's behalf. He pointed out that Logan was inside Charlie's Beverages for only 22 seconds. He did something terribly wrong, he said, but what didn't happen there was violence. And what didn't happen there was trying to take the law into your own hands or do more than what needed to be done, he said. He pointed to Joe's testimony when he said that he didn't feel fear and that he didn't feel like he had to defend himself. That does not mean that what he endured was pleasant, was right, or is excusable. But what he did have the instinct to do was to tell a young person with a gun to take it easy, to not escalate the situation, to not cause it to become more than what it already was. He said owning a store like that is a difficult business, but that convenience store owners are not trained like policemen on how to defuse a situation, how to cause it not to escalate. He said what happened at Charlie's Beverages, where Logan robbed the place with no violence, should have happened at Sunoco. He said there was no doubt that a young man broke the law and committed a serious crime. But he pointed out that Bob standing over Logan with the gun was not what they teach police officers to do and wasn't the wisest way to handle the situation. Quote, "And what had happened now is a 20-year-old kid is on the ground. He's got a gun in his pocket. He's been shot twice, and now a strange man who he doesn't know is on top of him." Then he said things got really bad when the OSCAs came in. He said the state wants you to believe that sometime while Logan is begging and trying to surrender, that he formulated a plan for murder. In 10 seconds or less, that he went from the same kid who walked into Charlie's and did something stupid and dangerous and just walked out the door. They want you to believe that now he's this conniving killer, that he's at the door with his hands up, starting to plan or wonder when he can get back to his gun. He said that's absolutely absurd. Quote, "Did Mr. Sposit die? Yes, it's horrible. It didn't have to happen this way. All of these converging events tragically caused a man to lose his life, and another young man's life to be changed forever. But you can find the right measure of justice. It's the justice that the family of Mr. Spozzett deserves. And it's justice for someone who is accused of a crime and who has basically said what he's done. But it's not aggravated murder. It's not murder, he said. The jury deliberated for about a day before announcing that they found Logan guilty of multiple counts of aggravated murder, aggravated robbery, felonious assault, and kidnapping. They found him not guilty of aggravated robbery regarding Carlo Russo, the local man from Charlie's Beverages. Logan didn't appear to show any emotion as the verdicts were read. At his sentencing, Logan's attorney, Jeff Richardson, said, quote, "Sitting beside me is a young man who managed in about 30 minutes to destroy his life. He, as the court is aware, has next to no criminal history. He does have somewhat of a stereotypical background of young people who sometimes find themselves in a little bit of crossroads in their life. He spent time in foster homes. One of his parents was incarcerated. I don't expect that helped him in his development. He was working at the time this happened, living with a girlfriend. The initial reaction from everyone who knew him was just disbelief and shock and pure heartbreak when this occurred." Richardson went on to say, quote, "Perhaps it's not the most popular of sentiments at this moment, Your Honor, but his remorse has been present from the beginning, and I think he expressed it to Detective Wells the first time he spoke to the police, so we would ask the court to take that into account." For their part, the state called Kimberly Spozzett, Bob's wife, to the stand to speak to the court. She introduced herself as Bob's wife and noted that they had three sons together. Quote, "I just want to tell you a little bit about Bob, how beautiful he was inside and out, a wonderful husband and father, and always there for us. Bob enjoyed life. He was happy and friendly to everybody. If anybody needed anything, Bob was there for them." She said they were a close family and that it's hard to believe that he will miss all the special moments with his sons, the graduations, the weddings. The fact that they won't be able to grow old together makes her angry. "There's not a day that goes by that we don't think about him," she said. "Bob does not deserve this. Logan Sinclair changed my family forever. We will never be the same again. There is a huge void in our life because our time with him was cut so short and it hurts. We will carry this with us for the rest of our lives. Time heals nothing. It would be wrong for him to get out of prison and go on living his life when Bob cannot. So we're going to ask this court for justice. Life without parole. I hate that he's still breathing because I know November 28th was not his first time. It was only his first time getting caught. He chose this. He walked into the gas station with a loaded gun. He knew what he was doing. It's just evil." She told the court that she wants for the rest of Logan's life to be just pure hell. She said anything less than 50 years would not be justice for Bob, because Bob did not deserve this. Logan also spoke to the court. He first turned to Bob's family and said, "I'm so sorry for what I've done to your family. I can't take it back, and it's no one's fault but mine. I can't imagine the impact this must have had on your family, and I can't imagine an apology that would suffice." He acknowledged that it wasn't fair for them to have to come back to court on top of all of it, just to hear him say he's sorry. He then turned to his own family and apologized. He then said, "Some people have said that I haven't shown any emotion during the trial or during the verdict." He said it's not because he doesn't care or that he's angry at anybody else. He said he's just trying to be strong for his family. Logan was sentenced to life in prison. He will be eligible for parole after serving 50 years. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the verdict? Do you think the sentencing is fair? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. If you'd like to hear these episodes ad-free and check out some bonus episodes I have up on Patreon, go to courtjunkie.com/support. Today's episode was a listener recommendation. If you have a case you'd like for me to cover, send me an email at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.